Is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, September 10th, 2021. And today will be better than yesterday. Producing from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home in New York. The National League East race continues to be defined. The Atlanta Braves in first place had a really good day yesterday. Facing the Washington Nationals, they came back a couple of times, and then this happened in the bottom of the 10th inning.
The pitch swung on, line to left field, base hit, Braves win! Jock Peterson with the game winner!
That was Joe Simpson, 680 the fan. Meanwhile, the Phillies in second place facing the Colorado Rockies, Philadelphia with a lead, but that changed in the top of the ninth.
Pitch, breaking ball, well hit to right field, and it is gone! First breaking ball of the inning, Ryan McMahon with a two-run shot. Touch 'em all time. 3-2 Colorado.
So the Phillies lose. The Mets were in Miami, and they had a 2-0 lead in that game on Thursday, but the Marlins would come back, and then in the bottom of the eighth inning, this is what happened.
Jazz gets a hold of one. A long fly ball, deep to right field. Conforto at the wall. Goodbye! Up onto the home run porch. Jazz Chisholm with his 15th of the season. And the Marlins grab a 3-2 lead in the eighth.
And they would hold on and win. That sound from 940 WINZ. And the Braves, at the end of the day, in first place, extend their lead over Philadelphia and the Mets. On Thursday, Red Sox outfielder Hunter Renfroe was on WEEI and told the host there that Major League Baseball basically told us to stop the testing and just treat the symptoms in reference to a recent outbreak of COVID on the Boston Red Sox. Renfroe continued, and we were like, no, we're going to figure out what's going on and keep trying to keep this thing under control. Well, Major League Baseball reacted strongly to that, saying Renfroe is completely wrong and inaccurate. The Red Sox also issued a statement to June Lee of ESPN saying, we've been following MLB's COVID-19 protocols all season long. We've consulted closely with them on everything we've done and continue to test. And their medical staff has been very supportive. We're going to be talking about that with Carl Ravitch coming up. The A's and the White Sox in the American League wildcard race, and Starling Marte came through for Oakland.
Look back in that direction, and he'll spin and throw, and he throws it away. Throws it into right center field. Marte's the third. Waved home by Kotze. He'll get there without the throw in time. Cut off by Abreu. It's 2-1 Oakland. All the way to third base is Matt Olson. Starling Marte on an E1 scores from second base to regain the lead for Oakland.
Yeah, Vince Catronia on A's cast. Oakland wins that game 3-1. For the Yankees, the hits just keep on coming. On the same day that Zach Britton underwent Tommy John surgery, the Yankees placed right-hander Jameson Taillon on the 10-day injured list because of a partial tendon tear in his right ankle. Aaron Boone, the Yankees manager, told reporters that Taillon felt discomfort in the ankle toward the end of his start on Monday. The Yankees' hope is that he's going to come out of a walking boot on Friday and miss only one start. Going into Thursday's game, Toronto had an opportunity to sweep the series, a four-game series from the Yankees, and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. did it again.
3-2. Guerrero swings and he skies one out to deep right field. Judge back at the wall. He turns around. It's gone! An opposite field moonshot from Vladimir Guerrero Jr., his 42nd home run of the season.
So the Yankees were swept in four games by the Blue Jays, and during that time, they never even held a lead. From the Elias Sports Bureau, it's the first time the Yankees never led in a four-plus game series since June 23rd to 25th, 1924, against the Washington Senators. They're going to be talking with Michael Kay, of course, the voice of the Yankees on the YES Network, coming up about the level of desperation for the Yankees. And over the weekend, Taylor, I'm going to get a chance to do a game with Michael Kay on ESPN Radio on Saturday, 20th anniversary of 9/11. And then on Sunday, we've got the Yankees and Mets again on Sunday Night Baseball. What do you got going?
Couple things, Buster. First of all, Fantasy Focus Football has been going on all week. I advise you to go back and check it out. They did their week one rankings for the first official weekend of the NFL Sunday calendar. Of course, you've got the ESPN College Football Podcast that's getting you ready for week two in the college football world. And also, don't forget, check out season two of Greeny Show, Better Days. If there's a game, someone's betting on it, stream season two of Better Days, the Mike Greenberg-hosted show that brings the true stories of unforgettable gambling adventures to life. All episodes are now streaming only on ESPN+.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Buster. Just go to Indeed.com/Buster right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Buster. Terms and conditions apply.
Michael Kay is the star of the Michael Kay Show on ESPN Radio and the television play-by-play voice of the New York Yankees on the YES Network. And on Saturday, he'll do play-by-play on ESPN Radio on the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And Michael, I'm sure the pregame ceremonies, and you've seen the itinerary, so have I, will be emotional, and they'll take us back to the days that we'll never forget.
Yeah, I'm sure they will be emotional, and those are days that, you know, the heart doesn't want to remember because it was so heartbreaking and so many people are still hurting from it 20 years later. But it does serve as a reminder of what could happen in this country or anywhere around the world, and we have to, you know, we have to keep our eyes open and things like that. And I can't believe it's 20 years. And the one thing that has bothered me as we come closer to this day, Buster, I've always like associated the word anniversary with a happy thing, a happy time, and you know, everybody's calling it the 20th anniversary. This is nothing to celebrate. It's more of a remembrance, but I guess for lack of a better phrase, they are using the word anniversary.
Yeah, I get asked the question a lot, you know, by journalism students or you know, fans will say, "But what's the most amazing thing you ever covered?" And I have to always qualify by saying, and what was the most amazing thing I ever covered was the events, you know, around 9/11 and the postseason afterward. And of course, you hope that you never experience anything like that again. Where were you on that Tuesday morning?
Well, I was sleeping and my phone rang and it was my mom and she said, "You should put it on the TV." So that made me aware of what was going on. And then shortly thereafter, as I'm just watching slack-jawed of what's happening, the phone rings again and it's Al Leiter. Al Leiter was on the Mets at that point and we had been friends from his Yankee days. And he said, "Michael, can I come over to your house?" And I said, "Well, why? Well, sure, but where are you?" He said, "Well, I didn't travel with the Mets to Philly because I wanted to take my daughter to her first day of school. So I was in a cab going to the airport, and everything's been closed down, and I'm in a cab right now, and I have nowhere to go. And I, at that time in my life, I lived in Hartsdale in Westchester, and I said, "Sure, come on by." And the cab driver ended up dropping him off at my house. And the weird part, the cab driver, a woman, was of Middle Eastern descent. And, you know, there was like a walkway up to my townhouse where I lived then. And, you know, Al's walking and she's like trailing behind him, like crying. We didn't do it. It wasn't us.
Oh,
and
geez.
Al's like saying, I know. It was just surreal. And he gave her a lot of money. He said, "Listen, I know you didn't do anything." He said she was crying the entire ride, saying it wasn't her. It wasn't her family or things like that. I mean, it was something I'll never forget, how strange that was. And then Al and I just spent a lot of the time watching TV, and then we ended up going over to my sister's house. She lived a couple of miles away, and my mom was there, and we ate and kept watching TV. Couldn't believe what was going on. And then later that night, when they opened up Manhattan again, Al took a car service back to be with his family in Manhattan.
I had Brian Cashman on the podcast earlier in the week, and he ran through what I remember so distinctly was that in those first 24, 48, 72 hours, there was real confusion about what was going to happen in baseball. What do you remember about that?
Yeah, I do remember that, because no one exactly knew, first of all, if the country was safe. Then no one knew the severity of what was happening. And, you know, over time we did. And then you didn't know, you know, what would be the proper time to start again, if it would be the proper time. I don't think anybody was in the mood. At least we thought this, Buster. I found out later different, but it just didn't seem like anybody was in the mood to watch a silly game. And, you know, as you know, baseball took about a week off and then came back, and people were in the mood. People actually needed it. And it did. It gave me some clarity on what sports means to people. It takes people away from some bad things that are in their life. And in this case, there was a bad thing in everybody's life. So they needed the sports to be a little bit of a diversion, even if only for three and a half hours.
Give me a moment that you remember that you felt like it was a pivot point in the understanding of that, as you're going through that in the first days after, of how baseball, the players, teams help people heal.
Well, first of all, you know, I went down at the time the Yankee games were on MSG, so I did pre and post game for them, and we went down to Ground Zero, and just how people's faces lit up just to see the announcers. You know, we were handing out Yankee hats and things like that, and just people wanted to talk just to take their mind off of what they were doing. People were like still sifting through the rubble at that point. So I remember that. And then I also remember, and it took about 2 weeks. The Yankees opened up in Chicago, as you remember, against the White Sox. And John and I were doing play-by-play on the radio. And I felt weird, man. I felt like I shouldn't be doing this. It's not right. It just didn't feel right. And, you know, my silly home run call is see ya. And, you know, I'm calling the games in Chicago with John. And when, you know, the innings I did play-by-play, somebody hit home run, I couldn't get excited. I didn't say see ya. And I just said, you know, it was as close to monotone as I come. And I remember getting back to Yankee Stadium, and there were all a bunch of letters that were there from fans. And they said, "You can't do this. You can't be different on the air, because that tells everybody that the world is different. You have to do all the things you do and be as silly as you used to be and joke around with John, and you have to say see ya, because this is how we get away from this awful time in our lives, that we can actually not think about it for 3 hours as there's a game going on. And if you're announcing differently than you did on September 9th, then we know that the world has changed, and we're hoping that the world hasn't changed long term." So that's when it really hit me that sports serves as a real a medicine for people. It really does. And sometimes we take that for granted. And I always look at it, you know, we work in the candy store or the toy department, and we do. But I think that people need that. I think it takes people away from the realities, the harsh realities of life.
Along those lines, that incredible World Series, and in particular, games 3, 4, and 5 in Yankee Stadium before that game 7 finish, so much emotion in Yankee Stadium at that time, you know, President Bush throwing at the first pitch. And that, by the way, that feels like a million miles away from now, because everybody in the country was galvanized behind President Bush when he threw out the first pitch that night. And then the emotional comebacks for the Yankees in games 4 and 5. What were those like for you as an announcer, those games?
Well, I'll never forget game 3. It was such a surreal experience at Yankee Stadium, in that you walked in, and usually when you walk into a ballpark, there's happy expectation and anticipation, but it was very somber, and the security was overwhelmingly suffocating, if I could put it that way. And it took people forever to get into the ballpark. And I remember coming to the ballpark that day to do the game, and I didn't know if I was safe. I didn't know if it was a smart thing to do. You know, I've spoken to a lot of people since then who felt the same thing. And, you know, I'm walking around the ballpark, and again, a very heavy security presence. And, you know, a couple of people that worked at the stadium pointed at the buildings that were beyond the right field part of the stadium. And they said, "You see those buildings?" I said, "Yeah." And I said, there are guys with rocket launchers up there." And that's just, it almost had a military presence to it, but everybody was trying to make it feel as normal as possible. And I just remember the goosebumps that I had, and the pride that I felt when, you know, a country that was under siege and had been attacked, that the leader of that country, you know, strode to the mound and seemingly oblivious to the pressure, you know, threw a perfect pitch to Todd Green, and kind of like the crowd exploded at that point, where they were happy, and they, you know, and there was no polarization, and there was no Democrats and Republicans at that time. Whether you had voted for Bush or not, you were so proud, and he was sending a message to the rest of the world: we're still here, we're not going anywhere, and our lives will not change because of you. And that was an amazing, amazing moment. And then you find out later that, you know, he was dressed in Kevlar from neck to ankle, and that the home plate umpire was actually a Secret Service man. It was not really one of the umpires. And that's how worried people were about an attack. And, you know, you look back on it, and then you're probably a little bit more scared about what you put yourself into at that point than you were at that point. So that game, I remember, was somewhat pedestrian. And then games 4 and 5 were forever games. You know, you take away the 9/11 aspect, Buster. I mean, those were just amazing, amazing games that, you know, will go down forever. And if the Yankees had won that World Series, you'd look at those games as two of the, you know, the best games of all time. But since the Diamondbacks won, you just look at them as amazing games, but they don't resonate as much in history for the Yankees as they would have if they had captured that championship.
Well, I look forward to and working with you on radio on Saturday, hearing more of your stories and memories from that time. Before you go, I mean, no one, I think, could have imagined earlier this year the desperation for the Mets and Yankees going into the series that I think we're going to feel, because the Mets now are hanging by fingernails in the race. And although the Yankees are in the lead for the second wild card in the American League, it feels like they're 5 games behind Toronto based on what we just saw. Blue Jays coming in and sweeping 4 games from the Yankees.
Couldn't agree with you more. You know, when I saw this on the schedule, I said, well, this is going to be a celebration and a remembrance of 9/11, a celebration of the people that, you know, obviously have lost families, and that they've persevered over all these years. But now this is a very, very important baseball series. And, you know, I've seen this Yankee spiral from the very beginning, from the 13-game winning streak to now, where, you know, they're 2-10 since that point. So what they did was completely eradicate all the good the 13-game winning streak did. I mean, it's an incredibly streaky team, and I got to tell you, and I know this is going to sound harsh, they didn't look like they belonged on the same field as the Blue Jays. I mean, the Blue Jays were, you know, energetic and lively, and they hit home runs, and you know, I think they had 11 home runs, and the Yankees had 2, and you know, the Yankees put the Blue Jays back in the series. You know, before this winning streak for the Blue Jays, they were 9.5 games behind the Yankees, and now they're essentially tied. So there's 3 teams for 2 wild card spots with the same amount of losses, 62 losses, and then lurking right behind is the Oakland Athletics. And, you know, 2 of those 4 teams are going to be extraordinarily disappointed and be left out of the playoffs. And, you know, I'm sure the Yankees would be the most crushed. This is a team that's built to win a World Series, not sneak into a, a one-game wild card situation. And as for the Mets, they just finished what should have been an incredibly easy set of games against the Nationals and the Marlins. And every single game was like a nail biter and a heart beater and things like that. And they can't score, and they didn't take advantage of, you know, opportunities to gain on the Braves and the Phillies, but they're still very much in it. So both of these teams could easily end up in the playoffs. But if one of these teams gets swept this weekend, that could really spell the end for them. So there's a lot on the line baseball wise this weekend. I don't know that when you looked at the schedule even 2 months ago that you thought it was going to have this kind of import. So it's going to be an interesting weekend in Queens.
Yeah. Whichever team loses this series, we're going to start to focus on, okay, what changes are coming in the offseason. That's how on edge it feels like these two teams are right now. All right, Michael, thanks for doing this, and I will see you tomorrow.
Okay, Buster. Thanks. I look forward to it.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11 ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
All aboard. It's the Rabby Train with Carl Ravitch.
Carl Ravitch, host of Baseball Tonight, of course, play-by-play man for ESPN and Rabby. Look, they scheduled this series on ESPN for Sunday Night Baseball months and months and months ago around the 20th anniversary of 9/11, because we know there are going to be really emotional moments this weekend. But wow, this series, incredible importance for both these teams.
Yeah, I know you and Michael discussed the significance of 9/11, and that always overshadows every aspect of baseball in New York. But, was there at Citi Field or Shea Stadium, you know, with Piazza's home run, and now you have these two teams, you know, in the shadows of the anniversary of that, with significant games, with significant news around each team. Every game, I mean, I know it's cliche, but every game counts. And now that we're at September and you're going to be looking at the 12th of September on Sunday, both of these teams are fighting for playoff existences, and neither one of them has been consistent enough to look at like you would the Rays or the Dodgers or the Giants or the White Sox or Astros. There's always uncertainty around them. And they seem to, whether it's thumbs down and Baez and Lindor or DeGrom, or it's the Yankees' inability to string together victories after winning 13 in a row following Iowa to look like the team that shouldn't make the playoffs right now. The magnifying glass is enormous. And to the credit of the great programming director, Rick Mace, we stepped in here with these two teams. And more importantly, it has to do with that 9/11 and all that goes with it. But the game itself is you can't overstate how important it is to both of those teams. And every game, not just Sunday, Saturday, Friday, next week, every game for these teams means massive stuff.
I am shocked by the inconsistency of the Yankees offense. It felt like it, especially once they got the 13 game win streak, it's like, okay, here we go. This is what the Yankees front office, Aaron Boone, envisioned, you know, in the offseason when they put this lineup together. This is what they envisioned when they add Anthony Rizzo and Joey Gallo. And just in watching those games, Carl, in recent days, it's like scoring runs for the Yankees is a shocking challenge.
You know, it's when they're going well, they bludgeon you. When a bunch of guys were injured and Aaron Boone was playing lesser known players who were probably a little more athletic and relied on bunting and moving runners up and stealing bases, there was just a different, obviously a different feel and look to them. I think when I look at baseball, and we do every day, and you look at the teams that are having success, and given that the Blue Jays just went in there and swept the Yankees, there's a youthful vigor about the way they play. There's an attitude about the way that the Rays play. The Giants are sort of a combination of both of those. We talked about dynamic offenses, and we talk about the White Sox, and we talk about the Astros, and we talk about the Dodgers, and the addition of Trey Turner to that lineup makes them far more dynamic than they were without him. The Yankees, I don't think the word dynamic would come to mind. And those teams I just mentioned are the ones that you fear more because they can just do more. They do hit with two strikes. They do move the runner up. They do take the extra base. And when the Yankees are going really well, you know, they're just hitting the baseball. Like, think about Stanton. Like, if Stanton's symbolic of the Yankees, it means he's killing the baseball. Like, that's how they win. They kill the baseball. Joey Wendell doesn't always kill the baseball. The Giants, you know, Donovan Solano wasn't known for killing the baseball. He put it in play. He hit it hard, but it didn't go over the wall every time. It's like if the Yankees aren't killing the baseball, they're not going to win, where the Dodgers and the Giants and the Astros and the White Sox and the Rays, they can win without that aspect. And I'm sure there are analytics that suggest it's not always that way with the Yankees, but it feels that way. And I think if it feels that way and they're not getting two home runs a game, then the chances of them winning compared to those other teams we just talked about, they're not going to win. And the Mets are a little bit like the Yankees that way. So, yeah, the inconsistency, I think, for me, comes from that aspect. They don't have enough seemingly different ways to win where those other teams do.
Earlier this week, Sandy Alderson, the president of the Mets, spoke about Jacob DeGrom's situation. And at the end of it, it had you scratching your head, which is why we had Stefania Bell on. And she, earlier this week in the podcast, described the reasons why he said made no sense. And then Jacob DeGrom, Carl, yesterday seemed to make, you know, throw even more mud into the situation. He was running onto the field. Reporters were standing there. He apparently didn't stop to take any questions, but he just stopped to give this statement. I know what was said, but my ligament is perfectly fine. I've been throwing. I wouldn't be throwing if I had a compromised ligament. That's the plan, to continue to throw and build up and see where we end up. I'm scratching my head even more, Carl. Like, the idea that his ligament is perfectly fine, that seems crazy to me. Why would he be out?
He wouldn't be if the ligament was perfectly fine. Look, the medical profession, and Stefania's wonderful at what she does, and she's the expert on all that. You know, but the sort of what appears to be, if not even a blurred line, the fine line or no line between tears and then other words to describe strains and sprains. And people will tell you, well, a strain is a small tear.
Right.
I would imagine that in that gray, that's exactly where Jacob DeGrom is existing. That there is something wrong there. There is something slightly torn there. Perfectly fine is his way of saying, well, it is fine for me to pitch, and we'll see where we end up. Nobody would say we'll see where we end up if you had a 100% healthy ligament. The same way that maybe Zach Britton was supposed to get a bone chip removed and he had, you know, reconstructive surgery. I think they're all varying degrees of constantly being injured. And then it's just how bad. I mean, Tanaka was an incredible example of somebody who was able to pitch with clearly what was a tear, if not being described as a strain. It was torn, but he was able to pitch with it. And maybe Jacob believes that he's going to be able to do that, or at least try. And as he said, see where we end up. Again, all those, anytime you get into these injuries and issues, you realize you're walking a tightrope, because the perception of one may be different from the perception of the other within the organization, let alone within the person's own mind who's dealing with the injury. And it's kind of a no-win proposition to speculate, because I certainly don't know. You know, you don't know. Jacob thinks he knows because the doctors have told him, and I would think the doctors would tell you there's a certain degree of uncertainty in all of these injuries, especially an arm and an elbow.
Yeah, whatever Jacob DeGrom thinks is in his elbow, it's different than what Sandy Alderson said the other day.
Yeah, without question.
It's hard to find a consistent strain of thought between all these things happening. All we know is that he's not pitching at a time when the Mets obviously could really use him. Before you go, what did you make of what Hunter Renfro said and, you know, the pushback from first Major League Baseball and then the Boston Red Sox?
Well, I say again, this isn't the strain versus the tear, but I'm sure that there is. I'm sure that in Hunter Renfro's mind, either he heard that or what he heard wasn't exactly relayed the same way from him to I think it was Lou Maloney, that. The Red Sox believe, and again, the Red Sox statement of we have listened to and continue to abide by all protocols for Major League Baseball. I don't have a memo in front of me or an email that says here's how we're going to proceed with COVID. I know that there are some within that organization who are curious as to why we weren't shut down when last year one case seemed to shut down a team, or two cases shut down a team and series were canceled. This year, given vaccination rates and given, I guess, the protocols for handling COVID, and thankfully nobody has died from this at the major league level, that they believe Major League Baseball, we can continue to play. We can control this. We can isolate. We've improved, as I said, vaccinations, contact tracing. And I'm not minimizing the way that it's being handled by any stretch of the imagination. You know where I stand on all this. But I think that they believe they have a better handle on it. And as a result, they can withstand teams having outbreaks like the Red Sox did and carrying on as opposed to closing down. Whether that's right, that's another conversation. But I'm sure that there's a certain degree of truth in what Hunter Renfro is saying, and certainly a degree of truth in what the Red Sox and Major League Baseball are saying. My guess is it's been a moving target, Buster, and it continues to be somewhat of a moving target, with obviously the belief from just about everybody within the sport that they're doing a much better job of controlling it and handling it than everybody did when this first started.
I think you described it absolutely perfectly, Carl. I think you described the situation right down to a T in terms of what's actually happening. All right. Have a good round today.
Thank you very much. And we'll talk soon. See you Sunday. Looking forward to it, bud.
Todd Radom is the chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America, all around the world. Or you can go to his website, toddradom.com. Todd, how are you doing this week?
Doing well, Buster. How are you, sir?
I'm excited because your forgotten franchise is one that's near and dear to my heart this week.
Yes. So, Buster, the Montreal Expos, they're not exactly a forgotten franchise to most of us. But the fact is that they played their final game almost 17 years ago. I was there, so they warrant a salute this week, especially for our younger listeners. Montreal joined the National League as an expansion club in 1969, and their birth was hardly easy. Their home stadium, Jerry Park, which I know we're going to talk about after, was not the club's first choice. That would have been the Autostade, a modular sporting facility that was constructed of 19 linked precast concrete grandstands, each 40 seats wide, arranged around a central field. Very strange. Jerry Park turned out to be a better choice, however, and it was hurriedly expanded to 28,000 seats in time for the Expo's inaugural campaign, which was less than stellar as the club went 52-110, finishing 48 games behind the NL East and world champion New York Mets. The arrival of Major League Baseball in French-speaking Quebec necessitated a whole new vocabulary, Buster. a knuckleball, le ball papillon, which is literally a butterfly ball floating about, wings aflutter. A pitcher is le lanceur, the thrower or launcher, and a catcher is le receveur, the receiver. The Expos tricolor logo deserves an entire segment unto itself, of course. And the team featured a host of great players and Hall of Famers, including Gary Carter, Tim Raines, and Andre Dawson. They fielded a series of championship caliber clubs, including the 1994 version, whose dreams were cut short when that season ended in a labor dispute in August, leaving Expo fans to wonder what might have been. The team was 74-40 when things shut down. Attendance declined as the club shed players, the franchise languished at Olympic Stadium, and the Expos played a quarter of their home schedule in Puerto Rico in both 2003 and 2004. In 2005, the club, of course, moved to Washington, D.C., where they play today as the Washington Nationals. But for 36 seasons, the Expos were nos amor, our loved ones to Montreal fans, and they are this week's forgotten franchise.
Beautifully written, Todd, for sure. And we'll see if someday in the future they'll have a baseball franchise back there. But you're right. I'm going to talk about Jerry Park because I got to go there when I was 10 years old. I called up the box score this morning, September 29th, 1974. They played the Philadelphia Phillies. Ken Singleton, of course, the longtime broadcaster for the New York Yankees in recent years, hit a grand slam in the first inning. And that's when I got the autograph I wanted to get from the only player I focused on that day. And that was former Dodger Willie Davis, who was traded for Mike Marshall, who would win the Cy Young Award for his performance that year. But Jerry Park, near and dear to my heart. What are your memories of baseball up there when you've gone there?
So I never made it to Jerry Park, which means I'm totally jealous of you, Buster, but you had greater proximity having grown up where you did.
Right, in Vermont. Yeah, yeah, it wasn't that far of a drive.
Exactly. But growing up in New York, I did get to one game at Olympic Stadium. It was 1988. Went up there with a couple of buddies. And let's face it, if you're in your 20s and you want to do a little baseball road trip, there are far worse places to go than Montreal. So we enjoyed every single piece of it. It was amazing. What an incredible city. But I remember a couple of things, Buster. First of all, Olympic Stadium, let's face it, not a top caliber stadium. It was very dreary in there. The roof was permanently closed by then. But I remember, it's just so strange. They played the Dodgers. And I remember these just vast hallways. It was a gigantic place.
Yeah.
And remember some strong Canadian beer, soaked up all of the atmosphere. And I do have to say, you know, I've been to Montreal several times since then. Just an amazing city. I love the fact that I can drive there. Feels like you're driving to Europe or something. And I do hope that Montreal gets a major league club again at some point. And hopefully they get a downtown stadium.
Yeah, and your description's perfect about baseball in the O, how it was kind of dreary. But on the other hand, me as a who grew up as a Dodger fan, I'll never forget when they played against the Expos in 1981, and in the ninth inning, Rick Monday hitting a home run. And I've told this story before about how I was running cross country as a senior that fall, and I waited and waited and waited before joining practice. And Mr. Mooney, my coach, was not happy about that. But I burst into the room as the team meeting was underway. And I was like, the Dodgers took the lead. And he didn't want to hear it. I don't think he was too happy that I was sitting down there listening to the Dodger game on the radio while they're having practice, you know?
Buster's Blue Monday. That's it. That was it.
Exactly. All right, let's get to this week's quiz.
All right, guys, here we go. This was the most recent expansion team to win its first ever regular season game. Was it the Devil Rays, the Marlins, the Royals, or the Blue Jays? Most recent expansion team to win its first ever regular season game. Devil Rays, Marlins, Royals, or Blue Jays?
All right, Taylor, what do you got? I think I got this one.
I feel like Devil Rays is the obvious answer. I'll go Devil Rays. I don't know.
I'll go Marlins.
Buster, you didn't overthink it this week.
Dang it.
It was the Marlins. They beat your childhood team, the Dodgers, 6-3 in 1993. And I totally remember watching that on TV. Charlie Huff throwing Papillon balls all over the map.
That's exactly why I remember it was old Charlie Huff, who, if I remember correctly, he was a smoker. So between innings, when they would pan to the dugout, you get the old knuckleballer who's in his late 40s and he's going back and catching his breath at the half inning.
Yeah. Oh, it was a different world back then in 1993.
Man. So, Taylor, I think we have how many weeks left? Todd, we got like 5 weeks.
It depends on how far we go. We just completed week 26. So I figured we probably take it up to about 32 or 33.
And I,
depending upon how long the World Series goes.
And I've got a 5-victory lead.
So after today, you have is Buster 8, Taylor 4, and 14 ties.
Which means we both got it wrong most of the time.
Yeah.
So it's crunch time. You know, I think if FanGraphs are doing this, they would have Taylor's chances for making the postseason around 3.6%. What do you think, Taylor?
That's better than zero, which is what I thought my chances would be. So there's still a chance.
Oh, my God.
Don't let us win today. I'm going to bring up Kevin Millar every week from here on out.
All right, Todd.
All right.
Thanks for doing this.
Thanks, guys.
Bleacher Tweets.
All righty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Glorious Friday. We have Jared McInnes at Cupstradamus. Jared writes in, 2-run game, 9th inning, Yankees trailing. Blue Jays coming up with 3, 4, and 5, all right-handed batters who collectively have 7 home runs in the series. Aaron Boone, I guess his thought process, let's throw a lefty with an ERA of 7 since we traded for him. Jared, really, really just like your thoughts on Boone's bullpen management last night.
Yeah, and I think Michael Kay defined it well during the 9th inning last night and saying, look, if it's a total reflection of how the Yankees' depth has been cut into. First off, it starts with the fact that Aroldis Chapman is struggling so badly that you can't necessarily trust him. They were holding back Chad Green potentially to close. Then you have the fact that Jonathan Loaisiga is now out indefinitely. Then you throw in the fact that Zach Britton is out. And so Aaron Boone, the coaching staff, is left to sort through a lot of imperfect choices. It's not to excuse that choice. It's just to give some more context. And by the way, Taylor, we got this cool Bleacher tweet from Chris Judge. You know, earlier in the week, we had that conversation about the flip play and sort of where that ranks in Derek Jeter lore. And in Tim Kirchen's piece, there was, he got some details from folks, oral history from folks from that night. And there had been a question about whether or not when Jeremy Giambi didn't slide, did Ramon Hernandez from the on deck circle run out and signal to Giambi that he needed to slide? Well, Chris Judge tweeted at us that if you skip to the flip highlights, you can see Hernandez signaling to Giambi to slide. And he's right. He included the video and he's exactly right. You can see Ramon Hernandez waving to Giambi, get down, get down. But Giambi came through standing up.
Love the forensic research there from Chris. Thanks for sending that in. Thanks for writing in, everyone, for the week. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter when you're watching games over the weekend. And please follow, rate, and review this podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts.
That's it for today. That's it for this week. My thanks to Michael Kay, to Carl Ravage, to Todd Radom, and to Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, check out the Fantasy Focus podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. The Baseball Tonight podcast.